Welcome to Sean Gittins' Puzzle By. This week, the show features a one-hour talk hosted by New Left Project, recorded on February 1st, 2011. The talk featured Dan Hind, journalist and author of the Verso-published book The Return of the Public, and Richard Seymour, author of The Meaning of David Cameron and the blog Lenin's Tomb. Taking place at Café Otto in Hackney, London, the talk focused on both authors' perspectives of common issues, including the current political climate of Britain, the media, notions of the public, and the global economic strife. Dave Wearing, co-editor of New Left Project, introduced the discussion.
Let me say something about Richard and Dan. Richard, first of all, Richard Seymour is a well-known blogger. I think you probably, most of you know his blog, Lenin's Tomb, which has been going since 2003?
Yeah.
Really well written, I think, really interesting, informed, insightful blog that I'd personally rely on quite a lot. And Richard also is an author of two books, Liberal Defence of Murder and The Meaning of David Cameron, most recently. We have brought Richard here to talk to Dan Hind, whose book is going to be the focus of most of this evening's discussion. Dan is the author of The Threat to Reason and, most recently, subject of this evening's discussion, The Return of the Public. Dan is a great author to read. He's very, very thought-provoking, I think, very stimulating author, and we're pleased to have both of them here this evening. Let me just tell you how this evening's going to go, and I'll get off the stage and these two can carry on. First, we're going to have Dan talking for about 5 minutes, perhaps, just introducing the ideas in the book.
Yeah.
And then Richard and Dan are going to chat for a while about those ideas and perhaps take it a bit more broadly. And then we'll do that for about, say, half an hour, something like that. And then we'll try and open it up to questions, comments from all of you. We'll do that for about maybe 20 minutes, half an hour or so. Yeah, so we'll do it in that format. Okay,
good. So. What I wanted to do first off is really skip to the end and tell you all who I think done it, as it were. The book is a mixture of things. It's a historical narrative to some extent. I think Rich and I will talk a bit about that. It's a diagnosis of our current predicament, and it's also an attempt to present a solution. Now, I argue in the book that there is a significant, serious structural crisis in the media coverage that we rely on at the moment, and that crisis amounts really to a crisis of legitimacy in our existing media institutions. And I further argue that we need to do something quite specific about addressing that crisis of legitimacy. And what I call that specific thing is public commissioning. Now, the crisis of the media that I see and that we'll perhaps discuss can broadly be summed up like this. The major media groups do not provide us with accurate and timely information about matters of crucial importance. That's really, in a nutshell, my kind of case in terms of what the media is doing at the moment. Two examples that I cite in the book in some detail. The run-up to the invasion of Iraq, and also the coverage of the financial sector prior to 2007. Again, we can talk a bit more detail about those later. But I think if you take those two episodes and you think about them for even a minute, and you try and sort of filter out the various apologetics that have been presented since, it's pretty clear that most people, most of the time, were relying on a version of events that was fantastical. And the fantasy became more intense the closer one approached to the circles of decision. So if you look at the storytelling, the fairy tales that were propounded in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, the key constituency that needed to be bamboozled was the American public, and sure enough, their version of events was by far the most fantastical, really, of any population group, I would imagine, on the planet. They thought that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the 9/11 attacks, very large numbers. Next time you hear someone talking about conspiracy theories, when you hear David Aronovich or Francis Ween, waxing all knowing and wise about conspiracy theories. Bear in mind that's the most dangerous conspiracy theory since the Second World War in terms of the number of people it killed. You could make a case for the conspiracy theory about international communism, but they're sort of level pegging. Now, the problems of the media, I think, are structural in the sense that they are the result of the power relationships that exist within media institutions and that exist between the media institutions and other forces in society. And I think it makes the media particularly unreliable when it comes to matters of peace and war and political economy. Two examples that I cite in the book I see as being just the most visible tips of a much more broad problem about how we frame analysis, the kinds of knowledge that reach us, and the ways in which that knowledge is embedded in systems of interpretation. And these failures, I think, present a much broader challenge to the governing ideas, the organising ideology, if you like, of the current moment. In particular, they make a mockery, I think, of the idea that some combination of public service and market forces can be relied on to deliver the public good. And again, I hope we'll talk about these related ideas, or these sometimes antagonistic ideas of market forces and public service later. But just consider for a moment the way in which the media are currently being debated. The questions that are asked about the media at the moment are things like, is there a sufficient plurality of ownership? Is the BBC too dominant? Has Rupert Murdoch overstepped the mark? What is not being asked at the current moment is how it's possible that the vast majority of the population can be excluded from decisions about what is considered newsworthy. And I think that's because public service and market forces are supposed to suffice. And we see, I think, if you look back on modern history, a kind of bait and switch between these two ideas. When market forces break down, we go back to public service. When public service breaks down, we go back to market forces. And as consumers, we're left really with the freedom to switch over or to switch off. We can head elsewhere for our information, or we can give up really on trying to build an account of what's going on in the world. I would argue that if we want to do well materially, we need to misunderstand the world. I would say that an accurate understanding of the world is not a good idea in material terms. But that's our choice. We can try and figure out what's actually going on and become increasingly marginalised, or we can go along with the prevailing fantasy, and we can take the media seriously when they say they won't fool us again, that mistakes have been made and lessons have been learned. So that's the choice, really. In contrast to that choice, I argue that the reform we need is structural in nature, just as the problems we face are structural. And in order to establish a more reliable system of information, I think we need to do two things. We need to democratise the distribution of material support to journalists and researchers, and we need to democratise decisions about what is granted access to a general audience. We can talk a little bit more about that if that needs more glossing. But essentially, the point is at the moment that decisions about what is investigated and decisions about what is public, what topics are publicised, are really the monopoly of a very privileged and very vulnerable and very small group of individuals in state-owned and commercial institutions. What we need to do, I think, is to take a sum of money and to make that available to a vote so that journalists and researchers can post proposals for inquiry and the public, as a voting public, can allocate support to those projects and can further make decisions about how much prominence the results of those researchers are given. At the moment, we are, as I say, dependent on an opaque and unaccountable elite to decide what's investigated and how much prominence those investigations are given. The final point I wanted to make before we start talking a bit more generally, there's a kind of liberal idea that media reform is good in and of itself. You know, making the media more plural, or making the media more this or more that, is kind of a good thing. It's something that we should be sort of vaguely in favour of. I argue really for media reform as a prerequisite for meaningful democracy. De Tocqueville once said that in a democracy, public opinion is sovereign. Now, public opinion in Britain and in much of the developed world is problematic in at least two ways. Firstly, the production of public opinion is not public. We have no ability to engage in the process by which our understanding of events beyond our immediate experience is created. Public opinion is problematic in another sense, in that we have no sure or regular way of coming to know what other people think. The stories we tell about our fellow citizens, I think, are just as wildly unsafe as some of the stories we tell about faraway countries of which we know little. If you listen to a reflexive strain of anti-democratic sentiment in Britain, for example, it's based on fantastical ideas about what other people think, which is in desperate need of remedy, and I think only media reform has the possibility of doing that. So changing the means by which we form our opinions and the means by which we become aware of what other people think are, I think, sort of necessary conditions for meaningful democratic government. So that's the whodunit bit. So let's go back to the list of suspects.
We're going to start with you break the history of the public down into a number of phases, from the classical public of ancient Rome up until the neoliberal public of late. And I guess we want to start with the neoliberal public because that's kind of where we are and it's kind of the crisis that we're in. I wonder if we could just look a bit further at the nature of this this public. It's a very different thing to what had persisted before in the pluralist era. For a start, there was the idea that the public would best exercise its will through the engagement in market relations. You know, as you put it, in a market, as a businessman is quoted in your book, saying that in the market, everybody has a vote.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
genuinely more democratic
yeah.
than the public sector. And so what you get then is the idea that people should withdraw from the state itself, and the state should withdraw from people's lives, and that they should regulate their exchanges with one another through basically through commodity exchange, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But another aspect of this, this sort of neoliberal idea of knowledge and public knowledge production, was something that is quite telling, which is the a certain aristocratic attitude. You got the belief that businessmen knew everything. I mean, literally, they could do anything. You got the boss of Sainsbury's coming into the state to, being hired by the Thatcher government to tell them how they were going to bring about internal markets in the NHS.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is crazy. It's almost as if you got an oil boss to determine how changes in higher education were going. But you get the point. There's this instinctive belief that businessmen should be brought into the government to run government departments, to run pension reform, and so on. And that there's something, and this relates back, I think, to a certain Burkean idea that the ruling class is the reasoning executive of the social body, and the workers just the limbs. And that therefore, anything they do and anything they say to be skilled in managing a business is to have the access to the highest form of organisational knowledge, and it means you can do more or less anything.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, I think the idea of as it were, a marketized state is described as new public management in the late 80s and early 90s in Britain. It has ruinous effects in Britain itself and is a kind of catastrophe in New Zealand as well, where it's applied more, even more kind of rigorously. It's actually a very old idea, and it's the idea that predates the crisis of confidence that you find in Britain in the later part of the 18th century. The state was understood as being a private aristocratic possession in the period before defeat in the Revolutionary War, really invents the idea of public service. So you have a period, I think, in Britain between around about the 1780s, 1790s, where the state is understood as being a zone that is cleared of market relations. Yeah. And that period really lasts up until the 1970s, 1980s, when the Thatcher government arrives with a stated mission to deprivilege the civil service. The understanding is that Britain has become laggardly, it's become sluggish, it's being run by out-of-touch mandarins who need the smack of market forces to wake them up. So you see things like performance-related pay being introduced into the British civil service in the 1980s. And this is, in a sense, a return to the era pre the reforms of the Napoleonic era. I mean, it's an astonishing kind of backward move by the British state. This idea, I think, that you touch on of the sense that there's something else going on underneath the neoliberal rhetoric, I think is terribly important. The architects of the right-wing shift in the United States, people like Samuel Huntington and others, when you see them writing about what needs to be done in the face of the democratic eruptions of the 1960s, they sound almost exactly like the defenders of order in the 17th century.
Yes.
It's the same villains.
Yes.
It's women and it's men without property.
Yes.
That are threatening the organisation of the polity by men who understand business. And business, as you say, broadly understood as being the things that men understand and the things that men do, men being understood as being a certain kind of man who's imbued with the right kinds of properties, essentially properties of mind. So once one starts to look at the relationship between different ideas of the public, the confusion or the complication is that various ideas have a kind of ghostly presence at the same time, and obviously what I'm trying to do in the book is to sort of disentangle the extent to which people are sincere but deluded, or sincere and they've got a grasp of something, and the sense in which they're producing ideas for popular consumption. Yeah. The idea of the market as plebiscite goes back to business propaganda in the 1930s, and it would have been the mother's milk of the business class who come to prominence in the 1970s. And say this quite self-consciously in their meetings, but no, they can't say it out loud. So in the authors I quote there, they say that they would always find anti-democratic sentiments being expressed by business leaders, but they would never say it in public. So I think there's a sense in which we have only very shaky publicity, if you like, about ideas of the public.
Well, I mean The two of the thinkers that I think are key, you cite Samuel Huntington, and the other, I think, is Friedrich Hayek. And both of these are Mandarin thinkers. They're elite thinkers. They're writing for elite audiences. And it's from them that you get the most accurate portrayal of where they're coming from. They're both quite explicit in saying that they distrust democracy. And that it's democracy should, in some sense, be rolled back. But there's also something else. And that is that neoliberalism is inherently suspicious of any kind of collectivity. And democracy is nothing if not a sort of collective action.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you could have, we were talking about this, Thatcher's famous statement, there's no such thing as society, there are only individuals and families. In that statement, she was being impeccably Hayekian. She also said that class is a communist concept. Now, I don't think she meant that literally. I mean, if you look back, class was in currency as a concept long before Karl Marx came along. She felt that the idea that if you acknowledge classes as a very entity, and the idea of, that there could be classes contesting for power, that you opened up the idea that what the rich were doing was something other than free exchange of commodities on an atomized market level. That what was taking place was something other than free, open, just an equivalent exchange. I think in the last 30 years, there's been actually a consistent attack on the language of class and the language of other collectivities too, on the part not just of Thatcher herself, but of everybody who's accepted that ideology. New Labour famously launched an attack on, Blair said the class war is over. In the same year he said that, a poll conducted by the British Social Attitude Survey showed that something like 81% of the public believed that the class struggle was actually still going on and very real. Polls consistently tend to show that people are much more realistic about this than politicians are. But the point is that absent that language with which to describe these social realities, and with changes in polling and so on, which are designed to measure these different categories, it almost becomes... I wouldn't say impossible, it's so exaggerating it absurdly, but very difficult to actually grasp the nature of the realities that we're living in. And, you describe the media's failure to represent adequately the financial crisis and the build-up to that to us. But in part, that is because of the presumptions, the language that they've internalised, which would blind them utterly to the nature of the crisis that was brewing.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things I'd pick up there. I mean, one of the things that struck me while I was writing the book, I was, as authors tend to be, I was in something of a sort of solitary fugue and inveighing against the ills of the world. And I found an astonishing statistic, which sort of knocked me on my heels slightly, because there was a Washington Post reported a poll in the late 90s that said only 3% of Americans polled thought that CEOs were responsible or trustworthy. And I think about 4% of Americans polled thought that journalists were trustworthy. So there's an immediate sense in which our understanding of what other people think is kind of wildly at odds with what they're actually thinking. And there's almost no arena in which those shared understandings might be explored. Going back to the centrality, as I see it, of media reform done properly creates public spaces where issues like class, issues like gender, issues like ethnicity can be broached in a way that's not being smothered by storytelling about how we're all feminists now, or there's no such thing as class anymore, we're all middle class, and so on. There's a whole set of governing frames, I think, that are used in the central media that make it very difficult for people to talk candidly about their social experience, and also make it very difficult for people to act socially, if you like, or to act in an explicitly political way and say, this is something that concerns me. And I'm not accepting the fact that it doesn't appear on Breakfast with Lorraine Kelly, or it doesn't appear on The One Show. This is something that concerns me in my life, and I'd like something to be done about it. I mean, if you consider the moral enormity of tax evasion and avoidance, and you consider what it took for that to reach the mainstream agenda, it took people bodily interposing themselves in shops. There is no means by which something that an awful lot of people are aware of and concerned about can get something more widely discussed, short of civil disobedience. The other point, which I think is very important, is this suspicion or anxiety about collectivities of all kinds.
Yes.
The regime of private property seeks, as you say, a market of free-flowing consumers, supposedly. There are all kinds of institutions that become very large and powerful within that. But the story is one, as you say, of an atomised market of individual decision-makers. If you look at the political tradition that predates English capitalism and English liberalism, English republicanism is exactly concerned with the question of how you construct a political collectivity.
Yeah.
And they're feeling their way towards it. They have no experience of representative democracy, for example. They have the vague example of the parliament. But what they do have right before their eyes, and it's very explicit in people like Wyn Stanley, is they have the example of the collective communal management of resources. And the triumph of liberal language, the triumph of the individual, if you like, in the rhetoric of the 18th century, coincides with the kind of legal gangsterism of the enclosures.
Yes.
You know, you have a group of aristocrats in Parliament, a committee of landlords, as it's described, who systematically smash these systems of collective management. And if you find resources, and if you find a group of people managing those resources, pretty much by definition, you find a constitution. There's been a lot of work done on communal management of resources. And the fantasy that liberals have that communal resources are poorly managed is exactly that. There is no such thing as a tragedy of the commons, usually. People are very good at managing communal property. And they're very good at regulating their use of communal property in ways that respect individual freedom and the needs of the collectivity. So I think you're right, there is this constant fear of, as it were, the monster of society, in whose name the virtuous property holder will be expropriated. And that fear of the monster is very, very deep-seated. And, you know, not wanting to stir up Freud, but it seems to me to be exactly the opposite. You know, it's the liberals who killed the collective.
Yes.
And stand in terror of being of the vengeance of the collective. You know, what happens if the commons come back? You know, how can we enjoy our estates if these damn peasants come along and start grazing their sheep on it again?
I mean, is that? I mean, you talk about how the destruction of real chances at knowledge. And, you know, the fact that they can't adequately, you know, the media, the dominant institutions can't adequately describe the world to us. They have to resort to fantasies constantly. One of the things that's exercising me of late, and maybe I could persuade you to sort of comment on it, is just this this way in which there's a return of the repressed in terms of the language of class. And that is that we're starting to hear the language of the white working class, a colour-coded class. And it's almost as if having neoliberalism, having destroyed the kinds of tightly knit communities, which, I mean, we sentimentalise, but there were real communities that did exist, and there were ties of communal solidarity. And neoliberalism, having destroyed that for the last 30 years, then says, well, actually, the real problem is, you know, your communities have been destroyed, but they've been destroyed by immigration. They've been destroyed by all these black people coming over, not by, you know, markets and not by capitalists or anything of that kind. So, I mean, there's almost a direct relationship, I would say, between the destruction of a social form, the destruction of an understanding of a social form, and then the production of a fantasy to, you know, provide a semi-coherent narrative about that.
Well, one of the themes in the book that I look at is the conscious and constant use of private categories to explain public realities.
Yes.
And you can see that in the very successful efforts by particularly Republican politicians in the United States to represent their personal qualities as being qualifications for government. And I think you can see as well a steady use, really, of private categories, if you like, of resentment or nervousness that are natural, the kind of the tensions that exist when novel groups meet, for example, the tensions that that are caused by the rubbing along of different kinds of people in a society. Those kinds of nervousnesses, which are natural and which fade with familiarity, can be mobilised politically. And again, if you look at the backlash against the democratic movements of the 60s, they're very conscious of the need to exploit fear of black people,
yes.
Fear of women as it were, a threat to male virility.
Yes.
The idea that feminism was somehow going to sap men of their vital essences, to coin the phrase from Dr. Strangelove. These are notions that are being very deliberately pushed. Now, once those ideas are out and about, they take on, I think, a life of their own to some extent. I'm not an expert in the politics of class or of community. But I think one should always be wary when one starts to hear language that is in some way emotionally appealing. You've really got to kind of hold on to your wallet at that point, because they probably have market tested it.
Yes.
And they probably figure that it'll swing idiots like you. And it doesn't really matter what it is, whether it's warm feelings of inclusion coming from Obama, or creepy stuff about shooting mooses from Sarah Palin. It's just different markets that they're appealing to. But you're still seeing the mobilisation of, as I say, private sentiment in what should really be a public space, which is not to deny the reality of difference, but it's to say that the proper resolution of our conflicts is in a public space, and it's not through this kind of this creepy interiority of imagining, as you say, a world kind of cleansed of difference, which I think is somewhere in that stuff about the white working class.
Well, I mean, and that also ties back to the politics of resentment that you talk about with respect to right-wing populists. But, I mean, we could, examine the neoliberal public, but I think it's worth also contrasting it with some of the previous conceptions of the public that you draw out. And you're quite explicit in that you're raiding the archives of history rather than trying to give a comprehensive history.
You call
yourself as a grave robber. But starting with Rome, I mean, you've got Res Publica. It's a public possession. The Republic is a public possession.
Sure.
And it belongs to a community regulated by laws, but this is an aristocratic public. It's thus a very exclusive one, and gradually it becomes a patriarchy, and a very solitary patriarchy, one dictator, the father of the nation. But that nonetheless forms the basis of future republics, and it's influential in the launching of American statecraft.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yes, I mean, I think as you say, the Res Publica is a public possession. It's a public thing in the sense that it belongs to all the citizens. It's also a public thing in the sense that it happens in daylight. And I think you find this very characteristic fear in Rome, which constantly reemerges in Republican movements. Fear of conspiracy. Fear of people in dark corners doing shady things. One needs to be clear that the Republican form of government is conducted in a neurosis of permanent suspicion, because it depends on levels of energetic engagement and levels of candour that can very easily tip over into factionalism, and can then be exploited by various kinds of aristocratic adventurer or usurper and so on. So there's an interesting sense in which a lot of the ideas and a lot of the adventure of republicanism, if you like, is enacted in Rome, and republicans from Italy through Holland and through Britain and America and so on have half an eye on Rome as a warning as well as an example. And going back to the point I made earlier, the English Republicans don't really know what they're doing. They're trying to build an alternative to absolutism, really, from scratch. And the model they happen on is the one they're familiar with from university. And there's a very funny moment where Hobbes says, you know, all this stuff about Republican freedom is just so much vapours from Oxford. You know, it's not it's just stuff they read and has gone to their head. What I think is interesting in a way about the current moment, if you like, and by the current moment I think really going back as far as the 18th century in Britain at least, is the sense in which the classical Republican ideal, if you like, of a community of virtuous men who run things is made secret, and it still exists. Yeah. If you look at the conclaves that govern the capitalist economy, you look at the governing powers that meet at Davos every year, the people who meet at places like Bohemian Grove and the Bilderberg Group and so on, what you find really is a probably quite self-consciously classical public meeting. But it has to do so under conditions of secrecy, because they can't say out loud what the Roman aristocracy used to say, which is that most people are slaves, and they belong to me by virtue of my virtue. They belong to me in virtue of my human excellence. And I don't want to overdo that. But the Roman Republican ideal hasn't faded away, and I suppose part of what I want to do in the book is to make it public again. So actually, Republican idealism can be something that we all share, with various kinds of caveat, with various kinds of precaution. It should not be left in the hands of the governing and possessing classes, because it's incredibly powerful.
You, when you describe what happens in early modern England, building up to the Civil War, or as some would call it, the English Revolution, and subsequently the Glorious Revolution, which is in a way a sort of capitalist restoration. It brings about a liberal constitution, a constitutional monarchy. It's justified by Locke in his extensive treatises on, you know, rights and property and so on. But you've got this idea of the public can go in different ways. You've got the democratic theory of people like James Harrington and Gerard Winstanley, who to different degrees believe that you can only have a public engaged in the state, you can only be a member of the public if you're a citizen. You can only be a citizen if you're properly franchised, and that means you've got to share in property. Everybody should have an equal share of the land in order to properly participate in the state. That's a profoundly democratic way it happens, and of course you see these arguments unfolding in the Putney debates, you know, but then it goes off in a very different direction with the Glorious Revolution, and with Hobbes, there's a sort of a hint of where it's going to go. I mean, it's the counter-revolutionary ideology that freedom really exists in the sovereign state, and that English freedom really is the freedom of the sovereign state to do whatever it likes.
Well, it's a twin freedom, isn't it? It's the freedom of this artificial creature, the state, which becomes, I think, an object of kind of almost religious veneration and fascination. And I don't think it's lost its hold for a lot of people in Britain. There's also a notion of freedom, the freedom of the citizen, or the freedom of a free-born Englishman to do as he pleases. And this is what is later characterised as a negative notion of freedom. It really comes to dominate public discussion of what it means to be free. Again, going back to this idea of secret and open, exoteric and esoteric publics, if you like, the group of aristocrats that replace James II with William III, they do so, it seems to me, as a much as a classical public would do. And throughout the 18th century, they are organising themselves in Parliament and they constitute collectively the state, and they do as they please. And they really do. I mean, in some senses, they live up to Harrington's conception of the public. It's just there are 1,200 of them rather than several millions of them. And so this language that becomes increasingly allowed in Britain after the Glorious Revolution, the idea that freedom is the freedom to do as one pleases, is a cover story for real freedom, which is the freedom to control the state. And that, again, I think is the dual story, really, of the public in this country. People like Isaiah Berlin pick up the idea that freedom's something that happens in private life. Human flourishing is an essentially private matter. And you can see the British establishment going, oh, good old Isaiah, giving the middle classes what they need to hear. But it's not true.
Yeah.
You know, the people who rule want to control the state because they understand that, well, their conception of what it means to be fully human is to be fully in control, or to be as fully in control as is humanly possible, given the restraints that are placed on you by your peers. English, you know, the freeborn English freedom is an interesting concept.
And we then move on to the idea of the state as impersonal government, run by public servants. And a public service ethos, mm-hmm. run by people who are self-consciously superior. You describe that this in the BBC. BBC personnel so confident of their cultural and intellectual superiority that they don't have any qualms about telling people what is appropriate to watch and deciding what's going to be on television or on radio or whatever.
Sure. It's more than that, in the sense that some of the cleverest and most sophisticated people in Britain spend their time figuring out what it is they would want to watch if they were some imaginary person who wasn't clever and well educated.
Is that what they do now?
That's what they spend their time doing. And the notion that they might ask people what they want to watch or hear it kind of spoils the fun. You know,
yeah.
That's what we do. We go and chat to these people, and we learn all about them. Then we come back and we figure out what they want and need. Yeah. And there was a great moment where the head of the BBC Trust was asked why there were no members of the public on the board of trustees, and he said, "Well, you know, we're viewers and listeners too." I mean, you know, so. So these public servants are completely self-confident and are very comfortable in that sense. The only thing that rocks them on their heels is the doctrine of market forces.
Yes.
And I think that you can see a kind of dynamic tension between these two ideas. If you look at economics, for example, you can see that Keynes is the great exponent of the notion of the public servant.
Yes.
Keynes is humane, he's phenomenally intelligent, phenomenally aggressive and impressive in debate. And he has no qualms about deciding just exactly what the balance should be between private enterprise and state action.
Yes.
And he has no qualms about deciding that, you know, really on the basis of his own calculations, how an economy should be run. And to a very large extent, in the Second World War, he is running the show. On the other hand, someone like Hayek is pushing for this kind of atomized market model, and sees market forces as a solvent or as a way of protecting against the spectre of someone like Keynes.
Yeah.
You know, the man from the ministry who knows best and who puts us in a kind of infantile relationship by deciding for us what we should decide for ourselves. And those two schools of thought, I think, have been exchanging places. I think market forces have been dominant, but you remember there was a period after 2008 when suddenly Keynes was back.
Yes.
When governments decided that bailing out banks was a good idea, they did it under the aegis of the return of Keynes.
Yes.
So these two kind of legitimating stories are available, and if you want to make the BBC nervous, you talk about market forces to them. And, you know, Murdoch's been doing that for a generation.
Aside from the class supremacist sort of attitudes of these liberal administrators who really dominated in the corporatist era, there's another aspect of this, which is, of course, that much of our civil service was schooled in India. They're schooled in empire. They used India as a place in which they could experiment in different forms of government, in exactly the same way, by the way, as America did at the turn of the century with its colonies. You know, they formed the American Political Science Association. They sent their senior diplomats and statespersons and academics, and they experimented with the colonies. Once they'd butchered enough of them that they would actually obey, of course. It took about 20,000 in Haiti, I think. It took about 200,000, all told, in the Philippines. But nonetheless, once they'd done that, it was ripe for experimentation. So there's actually a sense in which this sort of high-handed imperial attitude probably comes back into the public sector in Britain. And you have this in the nationalised industries and the public sector deciding arbitrarily what's going to happen. Whereas, I mean, the critique of the new left, people like Ralph Miliband, the father of the current Labour leader, argued that really this wasn't socialisation. Nationalisation wasn't what socialism was about as such. Socialisation meant democratisation. It meant ordinary people running things and having an equal and equivalent say. So that gives the neoliberals grounds to attack the public sector ethos, the public service ethos, as inherently self-serving, bureaucratizing, and so on. And there you get public choice economics and so on.
Sure. Well, I think part of the sting of as it were, the Thatcherite critique was that there was elements that were true.
Yeah.
And if you have these, as I say, if you have these two organising poles, you know, either we run things through the deliberations of rational, qualified public servants, or we allow the melee of market forces. The precise thing that's missing from these two approaches is everyone. You know, the idea that we might decide collectively how public investment is managed, for example, it vanishes in this model. Yeah. You know, we have no space in which we can debate, and we're encouraged rather to think that this is either a technocratic matter, something that grown-ups in another room will sort out, or else it's something that's like the changing of the seasons, you know, and the tides of the sea.
Yes.
You know, new technologies will emerge because of this magic thing and markets, and keep quiet. Keep going. And the idea that we might actually be able to consciously determine the shape of the future on the basis of a shared understanding is really, I think, I mean, that idea requires that we wake up from the notion that public service and market forces are adequate. And again, this is one of the ways in which the media is quite a fruitful area to look at, partly because no one looks at it, no one in the media looks at it, and partly because the notions of market forces and public service are so noisy in that particular context. It's such a crucial point, because it's without the legitimacy of the media institutions, nothing follows.
Yes.
So they're constantly saying that it's okay. People want to read The Sun. It's okay, right? People love the BBC. It's okay. Right? You're constantly going to hear legitimating stories about the media. And it's precisely there, I think, that the fix is in. And I think it's precisely there we need to kind of start picking away.
I mean, could we talk then about some solutions? Because, I mean, it's kind of transparent or apparent that the institutions that now produce our knowledge do so in a way as part of a sustained war against us. You know, I mean, I mean that quite literally and in all seriously. We've got a situation where the media is effectively, you know, acting as a way of channeling marketing materials to us. Whether that's in the actual the reporting content, which is all too often press releases, or whether it's in the form of advertising that makes up its pages or its filler for broadcasts. You know, that is essentially what it's for. So it's kind of intended as a constant psychic war against our perceptions to manipulate us into accepting certain ideas about how the world is and how it works. So we really need to move beyond that. And you propose a model of, well, you propose several things, but one of them is a model of public commissioning. And you mentioned the idea of having a separate fund. Could you go into that in a bit more detail?
Yeah, I mean, you know, going back to what we touched on earlier about the idea of the collective management of resources, there is, it seems to me, an argument for creating essentially pools of money or sums of money that can be distributed to journalists or to people who say they want to be journalists on the basis of a popular vote. One of the sort of defences of particularly the public service ethos is the idea that these are expert matters, this is complicated stuff. It's not something that really the public, it's not something where the public really knows what it wants until it gets it. And we shouldn't be afraid to lead public opinion in certain sorts of very constrained ways. Now, it seems to me that capability, skill follows opportunity. And at the moment, we really don't have very much in the way of an opportunity to begin to consider what kinds of information that we want. Creating funds of this kind would seem to me to be a way of creating schools in which we can learn what kinds of information that we want, what kinds of information we want more of, and what kinds of information we want to share with some degree of confidence with other people. So the idea of public commissioning is not simply a matter of supplementing the private commissioning process that happens in the existing media institutions. It's also a matter, I think, of really seeking to convene as publics around the single most important property that there is, which is to say, the content of our minds.
Yes.
Unless we're clear about what we think, unless we're clear about what other people think, and unless our sense of how the world is bears some relationship to reality, then I think we've got very little chance of changing anything else. So that's really the reason why I put such an emphasis on media reform. But obviously, once you've established the principle of people gathering to discuss what they want to know, it's a relatively short step from that to gathering to decide what they want to do. So, you know, implicit in public commissioning is a much broader sense that it's control of material resources that matters.
Yes.
And it's the participatory control of those material resources that our best hope resides with.
Do you think the new media, and particularly the social media, which is the subject of a lot of eulogies today, as a potentially democratizing force, or a liberatory force, do you think that plays any role in this? Or,
well, there's a couple of things that have been sort of argued, you know, as it were, against public commissioning or against this idea of media reform. One of them is that new technology is doing the job anyway. One is that, and you can see that comes across in ideas that the social media, for example, provide a kind of public space of the kind that I would seek to create, as it were, in constitutional terms. You don't need to have taxpayer money, or you don't need a proportion of the license fee to be allocated to this kind of commissioning, because there's an emergent sense that this will happen through debates and discussions on Twitter. There's the idea that organisations like WikiLeaks will get the information across, and so we don't need this kind of reform. And there's also this idea that foundations will do it. You know, people like ProPublica in the States, or the Bureau of Investigative Journalism here, will provide a kind of a version of public interest journalism that means that you don't need to make this kind of move. There are benefits in all these developments and trends, and they're importance I wouldn't want to sort of underestimate. But there is a world of difference, it seems to me, between the kinds of publics that might convene around material resources to which everyone has equal access as an allocator, and the kinds of communities that will emerge in social media. The people who use social media are not representative. The kinds of things that people are engaged with in social media are overwhelmingly, as you say, marketing materials.
Yes.
You know, it's easy on Twitter to think that Twitter is the half dozen or dozen people that I talk to and follow who are, you know, activists and who are engaged in various kinds of political debates. That, you know, the sum of engaged activity on Twitter of that kind is a tiny percentage of the whole. I've often wondered, you know, how many people on Twitter are in fact Coca-Cola Corporation. I mean, you know, I don't know, but I would imagine they have quite a lot of followers right
now.
And it would be naive to think that wasn't the case. So. You know, social media is you know, has enormous kind of potential, and I think it's been used very effectively in, for example, the protests in December, and ongoing protests, UK Uncut and the student protests. But I think one has to be wary, and I think one has to be aware of the extent to which very rich communication can take place within a knowledge community like that, which doesn't really touch on a broader public at all. And I think you have to be wary as well about the extent to which mainstream media institutions are still able to determine how these communities are seen.
Yes.
Part one of the things that I think is very useful and important about what's been happening the last few months is a lot of people have had an education in the difference between their lived experience and what they've then seen on the news.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, for the millions of people watching who are not involved in the occupation, say, they saw overwhelmingly the frames that the media were looking for. The media found the story that it wanted to find at various times, whether it was violent protesters or the students aren't concerned about anything but thieves, or whatever it happened to be. They could find the right vox pop, the right footage, to come up with the story that they wanted, while apparently giving coverage to spontaneous and authentic political moments. So I think there's ground for qualified optimism, of course. But I'm very keen that we try out the idea of, as I say, the communal management of resources, because I just think that would draw people into the process of creating descriptions who are not, with the best will in the world, going to be that bothered by Twitter.
The interesting thing about what's been happening in the last few weeks. Okay. Yeah. The interesting thing about the last few weeks, I mean, with what's happening in Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere, is that a tremendous amount of the information that we're getting on Twitter and so on, I mean, it's very important what we're getting from ordinary people on the street, but actually a lot of what we're getting is from journalists who are using Twitter to communicate with people in a slightly different way, and they're doing so in their professional capacity, such that, I mean, a huge amount of the information that's being shared is links to already existing you know, news corporations.
Yeah.
So it's a highly parasitic form of activity.
I think, you know, as we touched on this earlier, the kinds of information, as you say, that is being shared on social media is often being generated elsewhere, and it makes it possible perhaps to engage slightly more critically or engage in a slightly more connected way with the products of the mainstream media. But what we still lack, I think, is really the opportunity to commission primary research. There are no means by which we can commission journalists to go and figure out how the offshore system works, for example. And it seems to me that would be a priority for a lot of people. You know, how does the global financial system work? Given that, you know, our chances of owning a house or keeping a house or having a job or keeping a job are intimately linked with these issues, the comparative silence on this subject by the media is surely something that we if we had a chance, we'd want to break. And I can tweet, you know, 140 characters, I can say, you know, wouldn't it be nice to know how this system works? But that's not going to cut it. You know, we actually need to pay people to look at these matters for a long period of time in such a way that we come away with some better understanding of them.
You've been listening to a talk between Richard Seymour and Dan Hind, hosted by New Left Project. To find out more about New Left Project, visit their website at www.newleftproject.org. To find out more about Dan Hind, visit his blog at www.thereturnofthepublic.wordpress.com. And for further information about Richard Seymour, see his blog, Lenin's Tomb, at leninology.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening.